This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. The construction of the Alaska Highway during World War II was an enormous task. Soldiers braved one of the worst winters in history to create the highway, and some have compared the project to building the Panama Canal. Many of the soldiers who built the road were from black regiments, and they faced systematic racism while on the job. A husband and wife team from Weaverville, North Carolina, recorded the tale in a new book called We Fought the Road. Authors Christine and Dennis McClure join me now from Blue Ridge Public Radio in Asheville. Welcome to the program.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Hey, Christine, give us some context because, you know, Alaska Highway, I mean, I just threw in there that soldiers built it. I bet a lot of people, I didn't know that before I took a look at your book. It was built by the U.S. military during World War II. Tell us about the history of this highway.
Approximately 11,000 men, of which 3,600 were black. There were seven regiments that built a highway, 1,600 miles. They did it in 8.5 months. And during all that time, the men who were black were treated by the white with extreme racism and prejudice. And a lot of injustices occurred. So most people haven't heard about the black regiments. And most people here in Asheville and Weaverville, when you ask them about the highway, it's a tourist destination as opposed to realizing what occurred up there in 1942.
Yeah, if you knew anything about it at all, Christine, as you say, it's a tourist destination. It's a way to see Alaska. But the fact that it was a strategic interest in World War II, Dennis, may come as a surprise to people. There was real concern about a Japanese invasion, right, Dennis?
Yeah, if you look at a map, and unfortunately on the radio we can't do that, but Alaska contains the Aleutian Islands, which is a over 1,000-mile chain that is like a sword that points right at Japan. Well, in 1942, right after Pearl Harbor, from FDR on down, it immediately occurred to a lot of people that that was a possible route for the Japanese to come after North America. And so the biggest problem they had was that the huge amount of material and equipment, tanks, airplanes, anything they needed to have in Alaska and the Aleutians to defend, there was no way to get it there. And so they panicked, to put it bluntly, and they dispatched a Corps of Engineers and basically said, we need a road 1,600 miles from the closest railhead through Canada and into Alaska. And by the way, we need it in 8 months.
Yeah, so therein lies part of the answer to my next question to you, Christine, which is you talked about the hostility that black soldiers faced as part of this project. Talk about the decision to employ and recruit black regiments for this project.
Well, they all had to register for the draft in 1940, and many times in doing that, the doors closed on them. The white soldiers in the draft offices did not want to register them. But they did. They came up. The 93rd Regiment came at Skagway. They were kept isolated in this little town, and General Hogue did not want them there. So very soon, these 1,200 enlisted men were transported to Carcross, and then they set up their base there as they started to build a road. But there were many rumors that the white soldiers had. For instance, they thought the blacks grew tails. So the locals would come up to a soldier and say, show me your tail. And they did, and there was no tail. So or the blacks were very, very amazed and cold, and the amount of snow and the hawsers on the ship were full of ice. And when they traveled over the White Pass, there were 12, 15 feet of snow as this little tiny narrow-gauge railroad brought them to Carcross. So.
Yeah, and you talked extensively, Dennis, to two black veterans of the 93rd Regiment to complete this book, and they had some very painful memories about how they were treated. Give us a sense of what life was like for them up there.
You picture... I'm going to talk about one in particular, and that is Leonard Larkins. Leonard grew up in the early 20s under probably the most severe Jim Crow in the country. And in southern Louisiana. He grew up on a sugarcane plantation. He told me that he joined the Army because it paid so well. Well, in those days, a buck private in the Army made $21 a month, which I think speaks for itself. So now these guys report to Camp Livingston, Louisiana, and they go through a period of training, and things there could be pretty rough. It was in southern Louisiana. Now one day, out of nowhere, they are herded onto trains. They have no idea where they're going, and nobody's telling them. As they travel from Louisiana diagonally across the United States to Seattle, they literally pull the shades down on the railroad cars so that the good people in the communities are passing through don't have to see them. They take them off the trains. They put them on ships. They go by ship to Skagway, Alaska, and this is April, which in Skagway, Alaska, is winter. And then they take them off the ship in the middle of winter. These guys had never seen anything like this. And then they spent 8 months working on the road. They were deliberately kept. The Army did not want to use black regiments. They were forced to because they didn't have enough white ones. But they very deliberately kept these guys in the interior and away from white populations. They kept newsreel cameras. These guys got no credit. But the point was, from their angle, they did this. In December, they were shipped to help to build barracks for a white regiment while they lived in tents. And this is with temperatures of 40 to 70 below. And then they took them out and put them on ships and sent them to the Aleutians, where they spent basically the rest of the war. When that man came home, he had no desire ever to go back up there. He found it extremely difficult, and above all, and this is the part that sunk in for me as we talked to him, it was a humiliating experience. He didn't come home with pride because he wasn't allowed to see it that way. So now, as I think you may know, and I don't know if your listeners do, but back in the spring, a number of people in the state of Alaska who are trying to honor these men brought Leonard and three of his sons up to Alaska, and they treated him like heroes. They appeared with the governor. He was interviewed. We have photos on our website of Leonard's press conferences. When we visited Leonard again in November, he was a different man. And I think the Alaskans in 2017, whatever else had happened to him, they taught him that he had every right to have pride in it.
Well, Alaskans and all Americans, right? This thing was, road was seen as, I mean, obviously for this particular event, you're talking about Alaskans, but for the rest of us, the idea that this was something of strategic value had to be done, was done, and the African-American regiments never got the credit for it, apart from, and on top of the fact that they were treated so badly. In fact, Christine, let me talk about another episode in there, which is, you refer to as the Charlie Lake tragedy, the tragedy at Charlie Lake.
Yes.
Which is really precipitated by a fight between two commanders, and there's a General Buckner who refuses to let a colonel's black troops unload supplies, and this results in a decision to use a lake rather than a ground transportation. Tell us this story.
Well, it was General O'Connor. He took the equipment away from the 95th Regiment. It was black. But this regiment, where 12 men drowned, was white. It was 341st Regiment. And they did not communicate with the locals as to an alternative way around this lake. And they were having very difficult time getting equipment on the road because it would get stuck in the mud. So this Colonel Lane, who was the commanding officer of the 341st, decided to take a pontoon boat. And that's three pontoons, 24-foot boats, and then you build like a scow on top of it. And they loaded it with a command car and a bulldozer and these men. And most of them were from the Signal Corps. So they transferred this equipment right across 12 miles of the Charlie Lake, which is usually a very pristine, calm body of water. But all of a sudden, it raised, the waves came, it tipped the ferry over, and these men drown. And then they spent the next couple days trying to find the frozen bodies of these men. And one very sad story is Lieutenant Hargis, his wife sent him a letter, a telegram, and saying that his boy, the newborn boy, choked to death, and could you please come home? And then the commander of that of the 341st had to tell Mrs. Hargis that, I'm sorry, your husband is also dead. So this was a very, very sad time. And the commander that you said that argued with Colonel Lane was General O'Connor, because he couldn't understand what had happened, and he didn't know why the White Regiment wasn't surveying and building the road and moving on because everything was so fast. Mm. And it was a mess. And they did not ask the local people that you could actually go around this lake.
Yeah, so it's a fascinating story, and again, so much that we didn't know. Christine, it's interesting to know how you came to find out about this story. Your father was a second lieutenant, right, in one of those regiments. So tell us how
the
you
93rd.
Found out.
The 93rd.
Tell us how you found out about this.
I found his letters. My mother saved his letters from 1941 to 1946, I believe. And I had no idea. I knew nothing about the Alaska Highway. And we found photos, and my sister had the photos. And so I had to get books about it. I didn't know what it was. So it took me about 5 or 6 years to get enough information to say to my husband, okay, we're getting a truck camper and we're going on the highway.
How'd you feel about that, Dennis?
Oh, Well, I felt reasonably good about it. I really did. It's a fun trip, which is what at least I thought it would be.
Did your father? But let me check in with you again, Christine. In these letters, any mention of? I mean, because obviously you turned up a lot about particularly treatment of African American soldiers. But how much of that was reflected in his letters?
None. Mm-hmm. Absolutely not at all. So he was writing home to his girlfriend. So there was. Yeah. A lot of that, but then there were isolated instances in his letters about the highway, but no mention of the word Negro, no mention of the word black.
You know, you both served. Dennis, you have a history PhD from Cornell, and Christine, you have a master's in nursing, and both served in the Army. I wonder how you felt as you researched this story and you know, sort of as the story unfolded for you. Were you surprised at all of this?
Yes, because we went to Alaska in 2013 following Tim and his regiment. And then what we found as we traveled up the highway that nobody knew they were there. And at first that surprised us. And that's basically, I was there as Chris's driver and tech support. But we got to, very early on our trip up the highway, we got to places where we knew that heroic events had happened, and nobody knew it. And the highway has plaques. I mean, the highway is, it's like the Blue Ridge Parkway in that respect. I mean, everything is documented, except these things weren't. And that's what got us. And honestly, that's when I got as captivated as Chris, and we've been in this together ever since.
Clearly, so, I think, go ahead, finish your thought. Yeah, finish that.
Well, I want to say, as we have met with black audiences this summer, I think the question naturally, and folks are a tad hesitant, but the question of how did Tim feel about all this came up. And one lady, a terrific lady who has been a great friend of ours in Anchorage, told me to tell the story that Tim tells. It opens the book, if you've seen it. Because he was a creature of his times, and this was the way it was. But Tim told one great story his whole life about playing baseball when he was a teenager. And at the end of the season, his team was the champion, but there was a separate black league in their town. So there were two champions. And he knew his father would never allow him to play in a game between those two teams. And when he did, he went and did it anyway, and his father came out onto the field where he was playing shortstop in the sixth inning, and he dragged him off the field by his ear. So the years pass, and Tim is in Alaska at the end of the highway, and it's Thanksgiving dinner, and there are photographs showing Tim, and it's a couple of white faces and several hundred black faces. And Tim sent that photo home to his father, and on the back of it he wrote, "Come let me see you get me out of this one." Hmm. And in a strange way, I think that answered how Tim felt.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that was true of a lot of the young white officers.
Tim, of course, is your father, Christine.
Yes, that's who you're chasing.
Through this whole thing. So in a way, you got to – did you feel, Christine, that you got to know your father a little bit better through this?
Both my father and my mother, because he never talked to me about this at all, and I never knew the history of how my parents met. Usually fathers don't talk to their daughters about the war. So, yeah, it did. And once you realize the history behind it and then you read the letters again and again and again, things evolve and you see things. And I just became very upset and angry at how they treated these black men. So,
well, it's good of both of you to bring this story to light and talk with us today. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Christine and Dennis McClure, co-authors of the new book, We Fought the Road, that tells the story of the forgotten soldiers who built the Alaska Highway. They're going to be at Malaprop's Bookstore in Asheville Sunday, January 28th, and you can find out details at our website, stateofthings.org. The State of Things is produced by Anita Rao, Laura Pelliser, Jennifer Brookland, Robert Kinlaw, and Angelique Perrin. Robin Cobley is our technical director. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.